He burst through the double doors and yelled for the gate to be opened. A frightened guard complied, scanning the reader with his own ID right before Bernard slammed through the stubby metal arm. He practically ran down the hallway, taking two turns before he got to the most heavily fortified door in the entire silo. Swiping his card and punching in his security code, he hurried inside, past the thick wall of solid steel. It was hot in the room full of servers. The identical black cases rose from the tiled floor like monuments to what was possible, to the craft and engineering of human endeavor. Bernard walked among them, the sweat gathering in his eyebrows, light glittering in his vision, his upper lip wet with perspiration. He ran his hands along the faces of the machines, the flashing lights like happy eyes trying to soothe his anger, the electrical hum like whispers to their master, hoping to calm him. None of it worked. Bernard felt a surge of fear. He went over and over what could have gone wrong. It wasn't as if she would survive. She couldn't possibly survive, but his mandate, second only to preserving the data on these machines, was to never let anyone out of sight. It was the highest order. He didn't have to know why to tremble from the morning's failure. He cursed the heat as he reached the server on the far wall. The vents overhead carried cool air from the down deep and deposited it into the server room. Large fans in the back whisked the heat away and pumped it through more ducts down the silo, keeping the cool and dingy nastiness of the triple-digit levels humanely warm. Bernard glared at the vents, remembering the power holiday, the week of rising temperatures that had threatened his servers, all for some generator, and all because of this woman he had just let out of his sight. The memory stoked the flames under his collar. He cursed the design flaw that left the control of those vents down in mechanical with those grease monkeys, those uncivilized tinkerers. He thought of the ugly and loud machines down there, the smell of leaking exhaust and burning oil. He had only needed to see it once, to kill a man. But even that was too much. Comparing those noisy engines with the sublime servers was enough to make him never want to leave IT. Here was where silicone chips released their tangy scent as they heated under the strain of crunching data. Here was where one could smell the rubber coating the wires, running in parallel, neatly bundled, labeled, and coded, and streaming with gigabits of glorious data every second. Here was where he oversaw the refilling of their data drives with all that had been deleted from the last uprising. Here, a man could think, surrounded by machines quietly doing the same. Somewhere down those vents, however, was the stench of the unclean. Bernard wiped the sweat from his head and rubbed it on the seat of his coveralls. The thought of that woman, first stealing from him, then rewarded by Jeans with the highest office of law, and now daring to not clean, to wander off, it raised his temperature dangerously. He reached the server at the end of the row and squeezed between it and the wall to the back. The key kept around his neck slid into the greased innards of the case locks. As he turned each one, he reminded himself that she couldn't have gotten far. And how much trouble could this really cause? More importantly, what had gone wrong? The timing should always be impeccable. It always had been. The back of the server came free, revealing the mostly empty innards behind. Bernard slipped the key back into his coveralls and set the panel of black steel aside. The metal damnably hot to the touch. There was a cloth case fastened inside the server's belly. Bernard loosened the flap and reached inside, extracting the plastic headset. He pulled it down over his ears, adjusted the mic, and unspooled the cord. He could keep this under control, he thought to himself. He was head of IT. He was mayor. Peter Billings was his man. People liked stasis, and he could maintain the illusion of it. They were afraid of change, and he could conceal it. With him in both offices, who would oppose him? Who was better qualified? He would explain this. Everything would be okay. Still, he was mightily, uniquely afraid as he located the correct jack and plugged in the cord. There was an immediate beeping sound in the headphones, the connection automatically taking place. He could still oversee IT from a distance, make sure this never happened again, be more on top of his reports. Everything was under control. He told himself this as the headphones clicked and the beeping stopped. He knew someone had picked up, even if they refused anything in the way of a greeting. He felt there was annoyance hanging in the silence. Bernard dispensed with the pleasantries as well. He jumped right into what he needed to say.
Silo 1, this is Silo 18.
He licked the sweat off his lips and adjusted his mic. His palms suddenly felt cold and clammy, and he needed to pee.
We might have a, slight problem over here.
Wool, Part 4. The Unraveling. The Tragic History of Romeus and Juliet. The walk was long, and longer still for her young mind. Though Juliet took few of the steps with her own small feet, it felt as though she and her parents had traveled for weeks. All things took forever in impatient youth, and any kind of waiting was torture. She rode on her father's shoulders, clutched his chin, her legs wrapped, choking around his neck. Riding so high, she had to stoop her head to avoid the undersides of the steps. Clangs from strangers' boots rang out on the treads above her, and sprinkles of rust dust drifted into her eyes. Juliet blinked and rubbed her face into her father's hair. As excited as she was, the rise and fall of his shoulders made it impossible to stay awake. When he complained of a sore back, she rode a few levels on her mother's hip, fingers interlocked around her neck, her young head lolling as she drifted off to sleep. She enjoyed the sounds of the traveling, the footfalls and the rhythmic song of her mother and father chatting adult things, their voices drifting back and forth as she faded in and out. The journey became a haze of foggy recollections. She awoke to the squealing of pigs through an open door, was vaguely aware of a garden they toured, woke fully to the smell of something sweet, and ate a meal, lunch or dinner, she wasn't sure. She hardly stirred that night as she slid from her father's arms into a dark bed. She awoke the next morning beside a cousin she didn't know in an apartment nearly identical to her own. It was a weekend. She could tell by the older kids playing loudly in the hallway instead of getting ready for school. After a cold breakfast, she returned to the stairs with her parents and the sensation that they'd been traveling all their lives instead of just one day. And then the naps returned with their gentle erasure of time. What took 2 days and felt like a week or a month to young Juliet finally brought them to the 100th landing of the silo's unfathomable depths. She took the last steps herself, her mom and dad holding a hand each, telling her the significance. She was now in a place called the Down Deep, they told her, the bottom third. They steadied her sleepy legs as she wobbled from the last tread of the 99th stairway to the landing of the 100th. Her father pointed above the open and busy doors to a large, painted number with an incredible third digit. 100. The two circles captivated Juliet. They were like wide-open eyes peering out at the world for the first time. She told her father that she could already count that high.
"I know you can," he said. "It's because you're so smart."
She followed her mother into the bazaar while clutching one of her father's strong and rough hands with both of her own. There were people everywhere. It was loud, but in a good way. A happy noise filled the air as people lifted their voices to be heard, just like a classroom once the teacher was gone. Juliet felt afraid of getting lost, and so she clung to her father. They waited while her mom bartered for lunch. It required stopping at what felt like a dozen stalls to get the handful of things she needed. Her dad talked a man into letting her lean through a fence to touch a rabbit. The fur was so soft it was like it wasn't there. Juliet snapped her hand back in fear when the animal turned its head, but it just chewed something invisible and looked at her like it was bored. The bazaar seemed to go on forever. It wound around and out of sight, even when all the many-colored adult legs were clear enough for her to see to the end. Off to the sides, narrower passages full of more stalls and tents twisted in a maze of colors and sounds, but Juliet wasn't allowed to go down any of these. She stuck with her parents until they arrived at the first set of square steps she'd ever seen in her young life.
"Easy now," her mother told her, helping her up the steps.
"I can do it,"
she said stubbornly, but took her mom's hand anyway.
"Two and one child," her father said to someone at the top of the steps.
She heard the clatter of chits going into a box that sounded full of them. As her father passed through the gate, she saw the man by the box was dressed in all colors, a funny hat on his head that flopped, much too big. She tried to get a better look as her mom guided her through the gates, a hand on her back and whispers in her ear to keep up with her father. The gentleman turned his head, bells jangling on his hat, and made a funny face at her, his tongue poking out to the side. Juliet laughed, but still felt half afraid of the strange man, as they found a spot to sit and eat. Her dad dug a thin bedsheet out of his pack and spread it across one of the wide benches. Juliet's mom made her take her shoes off before she stood on the sheet. She held her father's shoulder and looked down the slope of benches and seats toward the wide open room below. Her father told her the open room was called a stage. Everything in the down deep had different names.
"What are they doing?"
she asked her father. Several men on the stage, dressed as colorfully as the gatesmen, were throwing balls up into the air, an impossible number of them, keeping them all from hitting the ground. Her father laughed.
"They're juggling. They're here to entertain us until the play starts."
Juliet wasn't sure she wanted the play to start. This was it, the thing she wanted to see. The jugglers tossed balls and hoops between each other, and Juliet could feel her own arms windmilling as she watched. She tried counting the hoops, but they wouldn't stay in one place long enough.
"Eat your lunch," her mother reminded her, passing her bites of a fruit sandwich. Juliet was mesmerized. When the jugglers put the balls and hoops away and started chasing one another, falling down and acting silly, she laughed as loudly as the other kids. She looked constantly to her mom and dad to see if they were watching. She tugged on their sleeves, but they just nodded and continued to talk, eat, and drink. When another family sat close and a boy, older than her, laughed at the jugglers as well, Juliet felt suddenly like she had company. She began to squeal even louder. The jugglers were the brightest things she had ever seen. She could have watched them forever. But then the lights were dimmed and the play began, and it was boring by comparison. It started off nice with a rousing sword fight, but then it was a lot of strange words and a man and woman looking at each other the way her parents did, talking in some funny language. Juliet fell asleep. She dreamed of flying through the silo with 100 colorful balls and hoops soaring all around her, always out of reach, the hoops round like the numbers at the end of the bazaar's level. And then she woke up to whistles and applause. Her parents were standing and yelling while the people on the stage in the funny costumes took several bows. Juliet yawned and looked over at the boy on the bench beside her. He was sleeping with his mouth open, his head in his mom's lap, his shoulders shaking while she clapped and clapped. They gathered up the sheet, and her father carried her down to the stage where the sword fighters and strange talkers were speaking to the audience and shaking hands. Juliet wanted to meet the jugglers. She wanted to learn how to make the hoops float in the air. But her parents waited instead until they could speak to one of the ladies, the one who had her hair braided and twisted into drooping curves.
"Juliet," her father told her, lifting her onto the stage, "I want you to meet
Juliet. He gestured to the woman in the fluffy dress with the strange hair.
Is that your real name?
The lady asked, kneeling down and reaching for Juliet's hand. Juliet pulled it back like it was another rabbit about to bite her, but nodded.
You were wonderful, her mom told the lady.
They shook hands and introduced themselves.
Did you like the play?
The lady with the funny hair asked. Juliet nodded. She could sense that she was supposed to, and that this made it okay to lie.
Her father and I came to this show years ago when we first started dating, her mother said.
She rubbed Juliet's hair.
We were going to name our first child either Romeus or Juliet.
Well, be glad you had a girl, then, the lady said, smiling.
Her parents laughed, and Juliet was beginning to be less afraid of this woman with the same name as her.
Do you think we could get your autograph?
Her father let go of her shoulder and rummaged in his pack.
I have a program in here somewhere.
Why not a script for this young Juliet? The lady smiled at her. Are you learning your letters?
I can count to 100,
Juliet said proudly. The woman paused, then smiled. Juliet watched her as she stood and crossed the stage, her dress flowing in a way that coveralls never could. The lady returned from behind a curtain with a tiny book of papers held fast with brass pins. She accepted a charcoal from Juliet's father and wrote her name, large and curly, across the cover. The woman pressed the collection of papers into her small hands.
I want you to have this, Juliet of the Silo.
Her mother protested. Oh, we couldn't. That's too much paper.
She's only 5, her father said.
I have another, the lady assured them. We make our own. I want her to have it.
She reached out and touched Juliet's cheek, and this time Juliet didn't pull away. She was too busy flipping through the papers, looking at all the curly notes handwritten along the sides beside the printed words. One word, she noticed, was circled over and over among all the others. She couldn't make out many of them, but this one she could read. It was her name. It was at the beginning of so many sentences. Juliet. Juliet. This was her. She looked up at the lady, understanding at once why her parents had brought her there, why they had walked so far and for so long.
Thank you,
she said, remembering her manners. And then, after some consideration,
I'm sorry I fell asleep.
1. A glooming peace this morning with it brings. The sun, for sorrow, will not show his head. Go hence to have more talk of these sad things. Some shall be pardoned and some punished. It was the morning of the worst cleaning of Lucas's life, and for once he considered going into work, to ignore the paid holiday, to pretend it was a day like any other. He sat at the foot of his bed as he worked up the courage to move, one of his many star charts in his lap. Lightly with his fingers, so as not to smear the marks away, he caressed the charcoal outline of one star in particular. It wasn't a star like the others. Those were simple dots on a meticulous grid with details of date sighted, location, and intensity. This wasn't that kind of star, not one that lasted nearly so long. It was the five-pointed kind, the outline of a sheriff's badge. He remembered drawing the shape while she was talking to him one night, the steel on her chest glowing faintly as it caught the weak light from the stairwell. He remembered her voice being magical, the way she carried herself mesmerizing, and her arrival into his boring routine had been as unexpected as the parting of clouds. He also remembered how she had turned away from him in her cell 2 nights ago, had tried to save his feelings by pushing him away. Lucas had no more tears. He had spent most of the night shedding them for this woman he hardly knew. And now he wondered what he would do with his day, with his life. The thought of her out there, doing anything for them, cleaning, made him sick. He wondered if that was why he'd had no appetite for 2 days. Some deep part of his gut must know he'd never keep anything down, even if he forced himself to eat. He set the star chart aside and dropped his face into his palms. He rested there, so tired, trying to convince himself to just get up and go to work. If he went to work, at least he'd be distracted. He tried to remember where he'd left off in the server room last week. Was it the number 8 tower that had gone down again? Sammy had suggested he swap out the control board, but Lucas had suspected a bad cable. That's what he'd been doing, he remembered now, toning out the Ethernet runs. It's what he should be doing right then, that very day. Anything but sitting around on a holiday, feeling like he could be physically ill over a woman he'd done little more than tell his mother about. Lucas stood and shrugged on the same pair of coveralls he'd worn the day before. He remained there a moment, staring at his bare feet, wondering why he'd gotten up. Where was he going? His mind was completely blank, his body numb. He wondered if he could stand there, unmoving, his stomach twisted in knots, for the rest of his life. Someone would eventually find him, wouldn't they? Dead and stiff, standing upright, a statue of a corpse. He shook his head and those black thoughts loose and looked for his boots. He found them. It was an accomplishment. Lucas had done something by getting himself dressed. He left his room and ambled toward the landing, weaving around kids squealing from another day off school, parents trying to corral them and get their boots and coveralls on. The commotion was little more than background noise for Lucas. It was a hum, like the aches in his legs from gathering signatures the day before. He stepped out onto the apartment's landing and felt a habitual tug upwards toward the cafeteria. All he could think about was all he had thought of for the past week, making it through another day so he could go up top for the chance to see her. It suddenly occurred to Lucas that he still could. He wasn't one for sunrises. He much preferred the twilight and the stars. But if he wanted to see her, all he had to do was climb to the cafeteria and scan the landscape. There would be a new body there. A new suit, with the shine still on it, glimmering in whatever weak rays the sun dribbled through those blasted clouds. He could see the image clearly in his head. Her uncomfortable sprawl, legs twisted, arm pinned, helmet turned to the side, gazing back at the silo. Sadder still, he saw himself, decades later, a lonely old man sitting in front of that gray wall screen and drawing not star charts but landscapes. The same landscapes over and over. Looking up at a wasted might-have-been, sketching that same still pose while weeping old man tears that dripped and turned charcoal to mud. He would be like Marnes, that poor man. And thinking of the deputy, who died with no one to bury him, it reminded Lucas of the last thing Juliet had told him. She had begged him to find someone, to not be like her, to never be alone. He gripped Landing 50's cool steel railing and leaned over. Looking down, he could watch the stairwell drill its way deep into the earth. The landing for 56 was visible below, the several landings between jutting off in unseen angles. It was hard to gauge the distance. Lucas was used to the much larger scale of stars, but he figured it was more than enough. No need to walk down to 82, which most jumpers preferred for its long, clear path down to 99. Suddenly, he saw himself in flight, tumbling down, arms and legs splayed. He reckoned he would just miss the landing. One of the railings would catch him and saw him near in half. Or, maybe if he jumped out a little further, maybe if he aimed his head, he could make it quick. He straightened, feeling a twinge of fear and a rush of adrenaline from picturing the fall, the end, so vividly. He glanced around and checked the morning traffic to see if anyone was watching him. He had seen other adults peer over railings after things they'd lost. He'd always assumed bad thoughts were going through their heads. Because he knew, growing up in the silo, that only children dropped physical things from the landings. By the time you got older, you knew to keep a grip on all that you could. Eventually, it was something else that slipped away. Something else you lost that tumbled down through the heart of the silo, that made you ponder leaping after. The landing shivered with the beat of a hurrying porter. The sound of bare feet slapping against steel treads came next and spiraled closer. Lucas slid away from the railing and tried to focus on what he was doing that day. Maybe he should just crawl back in bed and sleep, kill some hours with unconsciousness. As he attempted to summon some sliver of motivation, the speeding porter flew past, and Lucas caught a glimpse of the boy's face, twisted in consternation. Even as he sped out of sight, his pace swift and reckless, the image of his worry remained vividly lodged in Lucas's mind. And Lucas knew, as the rapid patter of the boy's feet wound deeper into the earth, he knew something had happened that morning, something up top, something newsworthy about the cleaning. A seed of hope caught a taste of moisture, some wishful kernel buried deep where he was loath to acknowledge it lest it poison or choke him, began to sprout. Maybe the cleaning never happened. Was it possible his petition had been reconsidered? Had the weight of all those signatures gathered over a spread of 100 levels finally worn the judges down? What if Bernard had actually come through for him, had swayed the presiding judge to lower Juliet's offense? Lucas recalled his appeals to Bernard, begging him as a friend, as his boss, to intervene on her behalf. He had asked him to add his own signature to the petition, which he finally had. But Bernard had warned him that her fate was out of his hands, that the judges would decide, that his authority as interim mayor made him practically powerless. And yet, if a porter had dire news on a day of cleaning, could it be that his friend had kept at it all night and had finally come through? That tiny seed of hope sprang roots. It grew, vine-like, through Lucas's chest, filling him with an urgency to run up and see for himself. He left the railing and the dream of leaping after his worries and pushed his way through the morning crowd. Whispers, he noticed, were already forming in the porter's wake. He wasn't the only one who had noticed. As he joined the upbound traffic, he realized the aches in his legs from the days before had vanished. He prepared to pass the slow-moving family in front of him when he heard the loud squawk of a radio behind. Lucas turned to find Deputy Marsh a few treads back, fumbling for the radio on his hip, a small cardboard box clutched to his chest, a sheen of sweat on his forehead. Lucas stopped and held the railing, waiting for the Mids deputy to reach him. "Marsh." The deputy finally got the volume down on his radio and glanced up. He nodded to Lucas. The both of them squeezed against the railing as a worker and his shadow passed, heading upbound.
"What's the news?"
Lucas asked. He knew the deputy well, and he knew he might spill it for free.